All right, what's up, everybody? This is Marcus Lewis, and this is episode 6 of the Ask a Jazz Dude show, where saxophonist educator Michael Schultz comes through, and we talk about quality control in the jazz community. Let's start the show.
It's actually episode 7.
All right, what's up, Mike? How are you doing today, man?
How are you?
Great. So, this is like the first time ever we're able to do a Skype integration on the show, so it's pretty awesome. It's the first.
Yeah.
How's the sound? Is that better? Did that sound go away?
Yeah, it's a little better. It's better now, yeah.
Okay. Cool. All right, so... let's get right into the show, man. So the people out there that are watching, by the way, people who are watching, comment and just let us know what you think about the sound and all that. And tell us where you're streaming from. That'd be great. So, Michael, just tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So I teach right now at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is about an hour and change from the Twin Cities, about an hour and 5 minutes from St. Paul. Personal player, I teach saxophone and jazz saxophone. I head up the jazz combo program here, and then also teach saxophone course. Did a master's in Cincinnati in 2010 and 2012. Then came back and did my doctorate in 2012 to 2014 when I moved up here. So lived in KC for 9 years before moving up here, studied with Bobby Watson, Zach Sheeman, and Tim Timmons there at UMKC, and being part of the Kansas, big formative thing for me. And even though living in Kansas City anymore, I still feel really partial to that scene and that lineage.
Of course. Yeah, man. So... I want to actually play an example for everyone. Speaking of the scene in Kansas City, and just I'm going to play an example, a video of you doing a really cool song on November 15th by Kenny Garrett. I really love this song. That album Songbook was like one of the greatest, you know, during my college years. I would just listen to that all the time. And then, yeah. You know, it's where I found that chord. There's that chord in that tune. It's like C triad over D flat. I use that all the time because of it.
Yep.
That's so. Yep. So I'm going to play that, and then we'll talk about it, and then we'll get into some questions.
Thank you.
All right. So and the so that was a notorious bass solo there. But for the sake of time, I wanted to get right back into it. So tell us about what that tune means to you guys, or you, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, it's funny, just recently, I've had a couple of students at Eau Claire that have been starting to get into Kenny Garrett. And it's interesting to me that, that album, which to me was just something that, it came out in 1997, and jazz like years after that. So it was an album that I just knew as sort of a seminal, is interested in the music would be familiar with it. But just recently I've had some students that I've had the pleasure of like introducing that record to them for the first time, which is really awesome. For me, I mean, that's like one of the definitive, that Songbook album is one of the definitive albums of the 90s of that kind of power jazz aesthetic that I think is rooted in the tradition, but you hear a little bit spicier harmony and you know, that whole band, that whole scene with Kenny Garrett was really incredible. And I think that tune, I mean, that's one of the most memorable of the record for me, one of my favorites to play. I actually just started playing it recently. This is from November. Fall was the first time I played it. So it's kind of challenging. It's a 29 bar form, kind of in a regular form, and a good mix of sort of functional and non-functional harmony. So I think one of his best, I mean, one of the best records of the 90s, maybe Kenny Garrett's best record. And for me, that's like the on the record.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool, man. So yeah, for me, I totally feel the same way about that record. So guys, this is you know, Facebook Live show. If you're just tuning in, this is Michael Schultz, great saxophonist, educator, based out of Kansas City, but now he's in Eau Claire teaching those students there. I'm lucky to have you. So yeah, guys, start to leave in the comments some questions for Michael to answer. What we love about this show is that we're just unscripted and we'll talk about anything. But let's get into our topic. I want you to speak on just a little bit of quality control in the jazz community. You know, I think in certain other genres, it happens a little more naturally. But in the jazz arena, it seems a little different. So why don't you just speak on your thoughts about that, and then I'll kind of respond with my thoughts as well.
Yeah. You know, like a challenge of playing jazz, which is kind of a little bit, can be heady and a little esoteric and kind of abstract for a virtuoso player, a pro level player, you know, an emerging, is really not happening at all. Right. And what I see sort of an issue, a lot of the people that have influence, be they, you know, media, club owners, promoters, sometimes aren't very discerning about the music. And so, like, the music per se, it has a lot more to do with the way that they promote themselves and the way that they invest both time and money into sort of being image conscious and promoting their shows. So I think, like, I'm looking at Kansas City, and I was thinking about this weekend because a great thing about Kansas City is there's still a club scene. Like one of the last places left, I feel like, there's a lot of club gigs or list, you know, specifically jazz clubs. And if you look at the Kansas City jazz talent, it's Bill Brownlee and John, incredible the amount, the sheer volume of gigs and music. But I was thinking about a friend of mine who's not a jazz musician, was visiting. She's from Eau Claire, or from the area, but lives in Eau Claire now. She works with me at UW Eau Claire, and she was down in Kansas City checking out music. And I was thinking, sending, she was like, where should I check out some jazz music? And I was thinking about, you know, I had to really look at that calendar and try and identify where to send her to listen, if that makes sense. Like, for instance, you know, I'm thinking about Minneapolis, St. Paul, for instance. I've dabbled a little bit in that scene, just living here, just a little bit. And they have this scene, that the clip that Saturday Night Jazz at the Black Dog, which is a series that's curated by a musician, really great trumpet player. And there's the thing that I love about that, I don't even have to check the calendar. I know that if I go to the Black Dog on a Saturday night at a certain time, I'm going to hear the best of the best in the city. And I think, you know, we have to push harder as musicians and kind of cooperate a little bit with club owners and people on the publicity side of things to help make sure that, you know, the offerings, the live anywhere else.
Yeah, man, I totally agree with everything you said. I mean, I have some slightly different comments. I'll just like piggyback off of what you said. But I think that part of it too is we like times are changing. Well, I guess it's always been this way, but like I also feel that like being a great musician, I think people get the idea from going to college that they can shed countless hours, which everybody should be doing. I'm not saying that that's not important. And then that someone owes them a gig. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I feel like you also have to be good at promoting yourself. You also have to be good at like being a good human being so that people want to work with you. Like, I think that like you have to be appreciative of your audience. I think a lot of times just like the reason why, certain people that may not necessarily, and this is just in addition to what you're saying, may not necessarily get the gigs is because they don't appreciate the audience and people don't end up coming back to their gigs. I think you have to engage your audience. You know, I think sometimes in jazz we think that like because we've studied so much and we know like, you know, a lot about harmony, rhythm, melody, form, theory, all these things. It's like, I think some people develop an attitude of like, you know, I don't need to like engage with people. They should just come to my show and then like, they should come to my show, listen to me, like buy my CD and then that's, you know, it. So, and then, yeah, the thing that you're talking about club owners, I just feel like, yeah, certain club owners don't necessarily choose the best music. And I don't know the reason for that sometimes. Like, my goal is to actually interview some of them on the show and, like, talk about what they're specifically looking for, like, how much are they invested in the scene, like, how much do they really know about the music or how much do they really, like, seek out the talent as well, as opposed to just being bombarded with emails. You know, so that's kind of my addition to what you said.
Yeah, I know. I'm definitely not trying to call out. I mean, I have great relationships with some club owners in Kansas City still, and I mean, some of them are doing, you know, they're really invested in scene and they treat musicians well. I'm certainly not the onus on them, but I think what you said is right, that as musicians, we're taking care of stuff and the way that we present ourselves on stage and our decorum to try and make the music more approachable so that if you're doing sort of the legwork behind that equal to some other folks that maybe are doing all the legwork and all the promotional stuff and music isn't that strong.
Right.
In the middle, I think, and like people that write CD reviews or you know, cover the music in a newspaper, we have to rise to that level. I say we, like I'm in that club, but, you know, the people who I think have high artistic integrity, you know, we have to be at that level from a promotional standpoint and not act like...
Yeah,
and I think, you know, I've learned a lot from playing. I have a great relationship with John Scott at the Green Lady Lounge and the... been really, really good to me and supportive of me. And
I learned a ton. When the club first opened, I think it was like 2012 or somewhere in there, and I got a gig there, and it was my first time playing there. I think it was only a couple weeks. A trio with Peter Schlamm and Seth Lee, and John wrote me a really clear email that outlined his dress code. You know, the musicians that play there know he has a strict dress code, all that stuff, and I kind of skimmed it. I kind of skimmed it and just read it as, oh, look nice or something like that. So I showed up in like a collared shirt and some slacks and was definitely not following a while before I worked there again. And, you know, what I've seen was that when he did that, when he instituted that dress code, you know, that the other clubs in Kansas City, a little bit of musicians had to kind of, and that small thing of looking really nice and having a little bit of an image really big effect on the way that music, even really abstract music, is received by lay people. Like, they can totally dig it if the musicians on stage have like a certain vibe.
Yeah, you know, I do think like image plays a part in it too, though. Like, there was an instance where I was playing at Noche in Des Moines. And this lady said, oh, I saw your big band at the Blue Room. And she was like, it was the most diverse group of people in the crowd and on the bandstand I've ever seen at a jazz show. And so, like, you know, people do, like, hear with their eyes sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, if you're in a suit or whatever, you know, people are going to probably take you, you know, more seriously. It creates a certain aesthetic, you know. She was just basically like, there are, you know, people from offices and you have women in the band. And, you know, it's just like, it was really great to see that. So, you know, like, sometimes we think like the music is everything. It's super important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like downplaying the music at all. But, you know, people do like, you know, they do hear with their eyes. You know, that's something that, like, an old guy told me, Sugarfoot from the Ohio Players, he told me, you know, it's like people, you know, people see with their, hear with their eyes, so.
Well, Brett, so, a few years ago, he was saying that he felt like, somebody asked him what was the difference.
Sorry, I didn't hear that because there was a police chase going on outside. What'd you say about Wynton?
That's my old neighborhood. Where the studio is like a couple blocks from my old neighborhood, so I know a little too well. So Branford said in an interview that he felt like they go and hear music, and in the States people were like, "Oh, we're going to go see some music," you know, exactly. Like just the verb indicating consuming the music, and that's something I didn't really even consider until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And it has a huge effect. It's received you, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I just want to take a second here to shout out some people that are watching. Adam Larson is watching from New York. Adam is a great tenor saxophonist. Sam Wiseman, Adam Slosman. Kendall Moore from Chicago is watching. Elaine Hernandez from Omaha is watching. Andy Swartz is watching as well. So thanks, guys, for tuning in. So if you guys have questions for Mike, just, you know, leave them in the comments and we'll start answering them. Because the goal of this show is the reason why it's on Facebook Live and not just recorded is for it to be interactive and to be unscripted. So yeah, start to leave any questions you have for Michael. So we're going to get into now. To give people some time to start sending questions, a video question. And this first question is going to come from Cody. And I think it's actually a really good question. So let's get into that video question. Here we go.
Hi, Marcus Lewis and Dr. Schultz. My name is Cody, and my question is, what do you think about transcribing the more modern players versus transcribing the older masters of the music? Thanks.
All right. So what do you think about that?
The question, transcribing modern What was it again?
Yeah, modern players versus the jazz masters that came before them, you know, like people like Bird, Train, whatever.
Man, you know, I think ideally, I think you want to be making sure that you're pulling from, I mean, I think that everyone needs to go through a strategy about getting into one player. That's something that I advise, something that I remember when I was an undergrad, Jaleel Shaw came to UMKC and he was talking about how he would tell students to spend like a full semester transcribing one person. And that kind of stuff, like, I think there's a lot of to that, but I also think there's it's really important eventually to make sure that you're pulling from a wide range of players. Harmonic and melodic syntax. I mean, a blurry line there, in my opinion, because I can say, you know, transcribe Harry Allen or Scott Hamilton. Like, they're contemporary, they're living, they're making albums today. But most of the material they play is really rooted in Ben Webster and Coleman Hawkins and, you know, people from different eras. So I think what I found over the years, I mean, is that maybe a wider spectrum of people, if there's a Venn diagram between, you know, the circle between the contemporary player and the master, there's more in that middle than maybe I would have initially suspected, if that makes sense. So
right.
I sort of draw a divide, and like, should I be checking out somebody contemporary and checking out somebody that, you know, checking out Bird or Frankie Trumbauer or Sidney Bechet or whatever? And I think in doing some of that stuff, I've realized that actually of a common thread between what they're playing in different eras. Oh man, no, actually, like by studying Bird, I'm skipping a lot of steps, you know, and then, you know, I felt like super athletic, you know, and like I had a lot together standard tunes, but actually when I had to improvise over some of that music, I really had nothing together. I think if you're somebody that's only transcribing masters and you're not hip to some of the contemporary sounds that are happening, you're going to be at a disadvantage, and I think the reverse is true as well.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I totally agree with that. It's like, I think, you know, if you transcribe modern guys, you're going to find your way back to, like, the people that were listening to you, too. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, so I think that if you just, like, transcribing, that's good.
Right. I think the other thing that happens, like, that happened for me is that, if I'm really honest, like, when I was Cody's age, I didn't really have any interest in Lester Young. I just didn't. And Ben Webster or whoever. Like, it was pretty much Bird on. And, man, I have to say that, like, I don't know what happened, if my taste changed or I just got older. I enjoy music of that ilk so much more. It seems like more of the older I get, the a little bit farther back. Because it's just a different aesthetic, and it almost sounds, in some ways, it almost sounds fresher than music that came after it, in a way.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was the same thing for me. It was like, you know, I got into, you know, J.J. Johnson, you know, because he was like the bebop. He's like, you know, the Bird for trombone players, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, all those guys that, you know, came before, you know, Jack Teagarden, those guys, like, I didn't check any of that stuff out until much, much later. So, yeah, I totally agree with that. Some people say your audio is cutting out. Are you using a microphone, or is it just your computer?
No, just my computer.
All right. So, yeah. So, how do you feel about, before we have another video question, too, that we'll get into in a second, but how do you feel about, also, I think, quality role in jazz? An issue that I have with jazz bands is we don't really rehearse enough, because everybody is just trying to, like, get as many gigs as possible because they have to pay bills, you know. But I don't think we really have bands anymore. Like, you know, like Ambrose's band, Wayne Shorter's band. Of course, they're fantastic players. Like, you know, like Ambrose is great. Walsh great. You know, all those guys. Wayne, Danilo, John Patitucci, Brian Blade. All those guys are great. And I think that their whole vibe is more powerful because, for one, they're a band. They play together a lot, and I'm sure they rehearse. I think a lot of times in jazz, it's like we're lucky if we have one rehearsal, and you know what I mean, or no rehearsal. And sometimes I feel like cats are just like taking gigs and not really being invested in the music. But the people are like fantastic players. You know what I mean? So the music doesn't come off as being authentic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's largely like, because I think that it used to be that maybe it seems like maybe it was easier to, like, I was talking to a very prominent, like internationally known musician recently, who's very established, who was saying how difficult it was to string together a tour, like over, and even really, really major label people, and they have their CD release tours, a lot of times it's like 8 or 10 gigs, right? So in order to piece together a living, you have to take on more projects. And as a result, because people are spread so thin, I think, playing in different bands, it's harder to get people together to rehearse. Like, I know if I tried to do an original music kind of thing in Kansas City, and if I want to call the best cast in town, you know, the best people that I think are going to play the music the best, a lot of times those are also, for a good reason, the busiest people. So it's hard to get them together to rehearse. I found that in some cases it seems like some of the best bands are not necessarily the best individual collections of talent. So maybe you get, you know, 4 or 5 people together that are B-plus musicians that rehearse all the time and are constantly contributing new tunes to the book. And in some cases, those bands are a stronger sort of group concept, a bunch of 5 or 6 A-plus players that just show up, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so people are saying there's some issues. I'm just going to really quickly restart our Skype call, so I'm just going to call you right back. Hopefully the audio and video will clear up, so everybody just hang tight for a second. Yeah, so I guess talking about the whole concept of, but I think it's because people are invested in the music, you know what I mean? Those players that you're talking about are a lot of times invested in the music, so it's like, even though there's no rehearsal, they're definitely like bringing it, you know what I mean? As opposed to, you know, like good players who are not invested in the music, they're just doing a gig. You know what I'm saying?
Like Bill Brownlee, for instance. I mean, Bill, I've been reading Bill's blog, Plastic Sax, for like, and I think one of Pete's observations is bands playing original music or what he would say is adventurous, and I appreciate hearing that perspective, but I think it's a product of how busy people are in Kansas City because there's so many gigs. So I think if you're really busy with a lot of different projects and you're spread free, the option of being spread thin, maybe, you know, the fortunate side effect is, yeah, some of the groups that might play more original music, that's a little bit more difficult to do in town. That's sort of a double sword to me. You know, I see some other cities like that I don't think have quite the infrastructure when it comes to the number of available gigs and how the gigs pay. But sometimes there's more creative music coming out of those people in so many projects, if that makes sense. So it could kind of go both ways.
I would like to know what skills or lessons that you learned during your classical training that you most commonly use in jazz performance and vice versa.
So if you can hear the question, basically Sam asked, what skills have you learned in your classical training that you apply to jazz performance and vice versa?
Well, I think like some of them, I'm going to try not to nerd out about saxophones. I think just in terms of, I think playing both more difficult instruments than others because the musculature inside the vocal cavity is different, and also externally, like with your lip, and the equipment that you play is much different. So a lot of my studies, you know, have just dealt with the. But I think one thing that studying classical, especially with Zach Sheeman, you know, we talked a lot about playing in tune and all the various alternate fingerings you can have as a saxophone player that would put you in tune based on your function in a chord, or the volume that you're playing, or you know, any number of factors. For me, most of the time, if I'm in a jazz section, like in a big band, most of those guys that are kind of coming through that training background don't have that same way that classical players do. So that's, I think, playing in tune and really strongly considering like purity of sound has been a big influence in the way that I play jazz saxophone the past few years. Like, my sound has really evolved just in the past 2 or 3 years especially, I think. And I think that's because of that influence of classical playing. And then in the reverse, like, I definitely think when I approach classical music, I have a... like, there are certain excerpts in classical saxophone that are from the diminished scale, you know, and or certain things, modes of melodic minor that we deal with in jazz all the time that, you know, I'll get to a certain passage and I've already got facility.
Yeah, man, that's great. It's very similar for trombone, too, because when I was getting my master's, I was going to get a master's in jazz studies. And then the school that I ended up going I was supposed to be the first jazz studies major at this college. And I got there and the program didn't end up happening. So I had to do like a lot of classical trombone stuff. And then the jazz stuff was just extra. But it definitely helped. I think it definitely helps. It's just like a different mindset. It does all apply. Cool. So do we have any, let's look in the comments here and see if we have any questions. Man, people are so shy today. So we did talk a little bit about quality control in the jazz community. So there's definitely some problems. So what are the solutions? To kind of just put a bow on it, like, what are the solutions for having a more quality jazz scene, not just in particular Kansas City, but anywhere?
Right. Well, I think it's kind of the stuff we talked about. We just have to make sure that, like, we're not the occupational reality that having a really good musical product is a given, and what's going to set you apart is kind of some of the extra stuff, you know. And the hard thing, I think, is if you're really serious about music and you're really invested in trying to be a great player, it's sometimes difficult to step away from the horn or step away from writing for a minute so that you can spend time and effort and money. And so sometimes it's hard to really justify doing that, but maybe that's we all need to accept. Maybe in a bigger point, if you are some and you are somebody that's playing a lot, you have a good reputation and a little bit of power to try and stick up and advocate for other people that you think are just deserving of that, if that makes sense. You know, I think...
Yeah, that's great.
You know, like, Clint Ashlock helped me a lot. You know, Clint, when I was coming up, he was kind of the first person that he was, you know, he was 7 years older and he was kind of in the scene already. And he was the person, you know, obviously we're really good friends too, but he was the first person I felt like that sort of heard that I was really working hard and that maybe I was developing a little bit of a voice and helped me get established in a position instead of put me in a position where, you know, maybe I can be of influence and kind of stick up for people, whether that be looking at putting them in touch with somebody or towards their music. It's a unique position where I feel like I can sort of stand for quality's sake.
Right. That's great. I like, what do you, you know, what is like quality? Cause like I made an Instagram post maybe about a month ago that was like, people were like, oh my God, I can't believe you said that. But it's like, I posted basically like, if Thelonious Monk was alive, he wouldn't win the Monk competition.
Because, right, yeah.
And the reason why I said that is because I think a lot of times, like, people, like, I think we pretty much, in general, as jazz musicians, give all the props to virtuosos. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if somebody's, like, super burning and has, like, a ton of technique, like, a lot of people, like, equate that with being good. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I can listen to players that, you know, play technically, like, perfect, but the music doesn't move me personally. You know what I mean? Or, on the other hand, you know, I can listen to people that, you know, have no technique and they're playing sad, but somehow they're getting gigs. And it's like, I don't understand that either. So it's like, how do we as like jazz musicians or whatever, as a community, like say what is good? Because a lot of times I feel like it's just like, man, this guy's like all over the horn, like, and people are like, that's killing. And I'm like, man, but like, it's not swinging or whatever. You know what I mean? You know what I'm getting at? Or
yeah, I know exactly what you're getting at. I think that's a tough thing, because you do have to allow for a certain amount of personal taste, because there are definitely people that, there are musicians who, other musicians that I respect have a high opinion of that I don't necessarily share, you know? So it's obviously, it's not, it's art, so it's subjective and it, you know, there's nothing cut and dry. Like, I've noticed with, especially with jazz musicians in particular, like, I think we all take a certain amount of pride as people in being fairly open-minded, whether it comes to music or politics or ethics or whatever. I think a lot of jazz musicians take pride in that. And so that leads to people being afraid to sort of take a hard... So I was just saying this to my dad recently via the phone, but you know, sometimes things do self-evidently suck. Like, I firmly believe that sometimes things would suck. Like, they just, on their face, they're not good quality. And I'm not saying we don't have to be, I really admire people that try to find the value in, like, any music. You know, they try giving the person a benefit of the doubt. I appreciate that. But at the same time, I think in certain cases, is making it nebulous to try and find the stuff that is good. So I think that, like, there's this term, the collective dig, you know, where somebody is sort of crowned as, like, the reigning, you know, famous jazz musician on the cover of magazines or whatever, or they get a Grammy nomination or whatever. And in many cases, like, if you really get good musicians to talk about it, to open up about it, they'll be like, yeah, that's, I don't really dig that. And, like, kind of undercover, people sort of collectively know that so-and-so is not actually that happening, but nobody wants to speak up on it.
Right.
I don't know what I'm advocating on. I'm not necessarily saying that we need to, like roast music, but at the same time, sometimes I think we try to be out open-minded in the next, like, it's a contest or something like that, and that ends up giving a certain level of credibility to things that actually just aren't that strong.
Right. Wow. That's well put, man. What up to Matt Ville watching us now? Matt Ville is a great piano player here in KC. Joe Schoonover, great guitarist. Yeah, man. It's a touchy thing because, like, yeah. Like, I think there's, like, musical talent, and then there's, like, who you are as a person. Then there's also, like, how strong your concept or your idea of who you are as a musician, and how well that translates to your listener. Because also, like, I think a lot of players don't really have a they're great, but like technically, or like musicians, but they don't have a strong sense of like, or enough self-awareness to like be strong in like who they are. You know what I mean?
Right. I know exactly what you mean, and that's something that honestly that I feel like I'm still kind of feeling that out. You know, at age 30, you know, I don't feel, you know, a lot of times where I'm in a certain creative space where I'm not my playing is not hampered by any self-doubt. I'm just like kind of in that space, you know, where I'm playing what I'm hearing, and but many other times something that's correct, and like sort of a balance there. For me, I definitely feel a little bit hampered by trying to give the right answers versus be like fully creative sometimes. I think that's a real, it's really difficult understanding chord scale theory and playing with good time and good feel and playing in a way that's rooted in the syntax of the music, but at the same time, a statement and develop a voice, you have to reconcile that with yourself. And that can be really hard. I'm sure you deal with it with future jazz too, you know, where you're trying to stress to the kids the importance of doing your homework and having the tradition, but at the same time you're trying to foster a certain, you know, personal musical voice. And I think that's really difficult to sort of reconcile those, you know, sort of opposing ideas of seemingly opposing ideas of structure and freedom.
Right. Yeah. So I guess closing, like, we got a couple minutes, just a real quick question. So the majority of what things I do are my own original music. I want to start getting into playing like more, you know, standard gigs and doing standards. How do you feel? Do you think there should be more? Because actually Herman brought up this a long time ago. He thinks that there should maybe be like a couple more clubs in Kansas City that actually support live music. I mean, not live music, but original music. Like, how important do you think that is for the scene?
I think it's really important, and I think there's this thing about like is the club scene. The musicians are not dictating what's played on the club gigs. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The musicians are acting to where the music is being played. And so in many cases, if you're playing at a restaurant, I mean, it's not really conducive to play original music, the right volume level or have the right type of catchy melody or whatever, or be something that's recognizable. So that's important. But a lesson from Herman, like I grew up with Herman Music, we've been together for 4 years, and the thing that people have not given him, he harvested a lot of the venues that people are playing in now. He had a lot to do with, like, he was either one of the first people to play there, or he made the call to the club. So I think that, like in Kansas City, I'm speaking as sort of, you know, dipping a toe in the water. The time is right for somebody to sort of cultivate a new venue that might be more conducive to playing original music. Because right now, like if I were trying to book a gig, I mean, I think Black Dolphin is it seems like it might be happening there. Like I'm playing there in March 17th with Clint, and we're going to play probably a good portion of it will be original music that we rehearse a little bit. But I agree with Herman's point. I mean, I think one of the cool things is the tradition of playing standards and knowing tunes and all that kind of stuff, but there probably could be a little between, you know, playing original contemporary compositions and playing standards.
Yeah. Taylor, man. So, we're going to close out the show. You said you got a gig coming up on March 17th. You got anything else you want to plug? Do you have a project coming out or anything?
So, I'm playing in Kansas City the 16th at the Blue Room. and the 17th and Black Dolphin. And from Missouri and Warrensburg. And then playing, doing a little something with their jazz ensembles on the 12th. So I'll be back in the area those few times. That's about it, like, coming up for me. That's not sort of like just a little hit here.
Cool. So, yeah, I'm going to put a link up. I've got your socials down in the screen. Everybody want to find out more about Michael, you can go to his website, www.michaelschultz.net. The link's on the Facebook right there, so you can find out more about him. He's really doing a lot for jazz scene, and also from the educational front. So it's really cool. So Mike, man, thanks for joining us on the first Skype ever Ask a Jazz Dude show. It wasn't perfect technically, but it'll get better. And thanks for taking the time out to do the show.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me, Mark, and congratulations on Charlotte Street, man. That's amazing. Very
thank you, man. Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable. So I'm stoked. I can't believe it. But, yeah, it's kind of surreal, actually. It still hasn't really sunk in yet, but I'm going to try to make the most out of it. So, cool.
That's great.
Everybody, what was that?
I said they picked the right person. That was really great news to see that.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you. That means a lot coming from you. All right. So, guys, if you are watching on KKFI, tune in right now to Sam Wiseman's show, Jazz in the Afternoon. You can watch that or listen to that on KKFI.org. Thanks so much. This has been episode 6 of Ask Jazz Dude Show with saxophonist Michael Schultz. Thank you for watching. See you next week where our guest is Jen Weismeyer from Kansas City Jazz Ambassadors. We're going to talk about the great things they're doing for the scene here in Kansas City. See you next time, squad.
All right. Thanks, Marcus. We'll see you.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.